This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, draw language in The Secret Santa and re-gift the bath bombs it gave me last year. This is the second half of the pair of episodes about engravings. The first was about epitaphs on gravestones, and this episode, similarly, is about words engraved onto a very durable substance, where they'll be read by generations to come. The episode was reported by producer Arlie Adlington. On with the show.
I like how this is typical of all antique jewellery in a way. It's just completely unsymmetrical and totally imperfect. You know, in a world of perceived perfection now, this is far more interesting. You know, you can really see that somebody's done that by hand. You know, the A is lower than the Z, and the E, the horizontal arms of the E are too short, you know, by modern standards. Certainly not perfect. You know, there's bits and pieces of the letters missing, but you can really put yourself in the position of the person doing it, who obviously was not able to achieve this kind of perceived perfection because they're human. People definitely still want to have things engraved, but being an engraver is not a highly paid aspect of our trade. And the nature of London and modern life is that how can you afford to go into that profession if it doesn't allow you to live?
And luckily for us, there's still work out there for us, but it's a dying trade. We're probably the youngest people that still do it in London. You know, as engravers retire and less come through, then they just sort of either don't have it engraved or they'll just move across to machine. And you can't do everything by machine. There's probably 50% of what we do you couldn't do by machine, but if you can't get it done, you don't advertise it.
Stephen Yardley is the Yardley half of Milne and Yardley, based in Mayfair in London. They specialise in hand engraving.
We're in a workshop, second floor, above Brown's restaurant. And basically, there's two benches and two of us doing hand engraving, the old traditional way. Simple as that, really. This is where we originally started, both of us, when we were 16, 17 years old, yeah. Amazing. So, yeah, not really been in, only been in about two rooms in our life working. And nothing really changes, really. We just use the same tools as we did when we were apprentices. It's probably one of the very few parts of the jewellery trade that hasn't really been affected by technology at all. So the tools are not powered by electricity or anything, just by us. Like pieces of stainless steel, we just sharpen them to a point. The only electricity we use is a lamp. That's it. So, yeah, so nothing's really changed. I don't think anything's changed in the way that we do jobs now as we did when we were 16 years old. There's nothing we haven't really engraved if it's not to do with jewellery. Right from, like, Rob's over there, he's doing now a coat of arms on a pen stand, silver pen stand. I'm doing a silver photo frame. Earlier, we were doing wedding rings.
So my name is Max Ullman. We are in my family shop with my dad and my sister. So we run a antique jewellery shop in central London. It was my great-grandfather's business originally. Started in 1900 in Budapest. And then in London since 1950 by my grandfather. My dad has been here since 1958. And in the last 15, 20 years or so, me and two of my sisters have joined.
Do you see a lot of objects come in that have engravings on them?
Yeah, tons, tons. Because of the nature of what we do, which is primarily antiques. So you're talking about things from, you know, early 1900s, early 1800s. So, you know, in those periods, there was a lot of reasons why people would have things engraved. A lot of the reasons are similar to today for personalization and that sort of thing. Yeah, lots and lots of other reasons why people would have had things engraved over the years. Lots of symbolism, lots of, you know, decorative purposes. The Victorians loved engraving things. So any number of objects in our shop right now, you'll see have got tons of wonderful, weird and wonderful patterns engraved on them representing all sorts of things which define the era that they were made in. You know, and you can see them changing over the years. You can see the engravings change dramatically. And obviously throughout the years, people have had names and inscriptions and dates engraved to personalise their objects.
Majority of our work is about occasions, you know, whether it be christening, you know, wedding, birthdays and things like that, so.
Have you ever got any, like, really weird requests or...?
We've put some weird stuff inside wedding rings before, but, I mean, I couldn't remember.
Kind of stuff?
Well, some of it you probably wouldn't want to put on your podcast.
You there's no
sense. No, they're normally, sometimes you might get a couple that want to put something like quite sexual inside something towards one another. Whether they live to regret it 10 years later, I've got no idea.
Looking back like, oh yeah, remember when we used to
Yeah, probably looking at each other in disgust now after a few years. But yeah, so you get something like that occasionally, and there's been a few things that we've had up here engraved and thought, that's not right, you know.
Restored a widow's companion.
Yeah, right? Widow's companion.
We'll let you draw your own
conclusion to it. So we had one of those. I think very early days when Tiffany's, I don't think they'd get away with that now. When Tiffany's first opened, they did, didn't they? Rob, is that correct? They used to do, what'd they call them? The toot snoot, wasn't it? They used to have a toot snoot. Straw. Silver ones.
Really?
Yeah.
They sold them.
They did, for a very short period of time. Okay. I don't think it passed. Yeah, they didn't advertise them. I don't know what they actually had, but we know that's what they were for. Mm. So, yeah, so you've seen some funny things over the years, but we just do it so many times. I couldn't tell you what I've engraved today, what messages I've done. I've done quite a few messages today, but I wouldn't be able to tell you what they were. You just, as long as you spell it correctly. Oh, yeah, you've got to be able to spell quite well. You learn very quickly to see a word that's wrong. You don't maybe know how to spell it correctly yourself. You think, hang on, that just doesn't look right. To be fair, we don't make many mistakes during a year at all.
When people come in and are looking at the objects that you have, do you think that something having an engraving from a past owner makes it more appealing to people or less appealing, or does it depend on the situation?
I mean, massively more appealing to us. Every now and then people will ask us to take an engraving out, but on the whole, because of the fact that we are an antique shop, most people who come into our shop are interested in antiques, and therefore they find the personalised inscription from somebody else very attractive and intriguing, rather than it being impersonal, you know, which is the perception, I suppose, which some people would have. You know, why would you want to have somebody else's engraving on there? Well, if it happens to be from 150 years ago, wow, that's quite amazing.
Yeah, so, it gives a sense of history to the object.
Absolutely, it's part of the personality of it, you know, which is essentially what we are selling, jewellery with a personality, yeah.
When I got the ring was the first time I was travelling abroad for work. It was the first time I travelled abroad, and I was slightly concerned that I was going to get hassle from men because I wasn't married. So my mum says, well, shall I give you this ring and then you can wear it to make it look like I was married and I wouldn't get hassle from random guys. She lent me the ring and I haven't given it back. My name's Lisa Hack. I'm wearing my grandmother's wedding ring, which is engraved on the inside with the date of their wedding in a kind of old style sort of serif font inside, and it's got the initials of my grandparents, HVV and MDW, and it's the 17th of the 8th, 43, and then the gold mark. And the names of my grandparents are Henry Virapatra Vandiyar and Mary Dotton Wood, and they got married in 17th of August, 1943 in Georgetown, which was then British Guyana and now the Republic of Guyana. And what I know of the ring is that it was probably made by my granddad's brother's family. They had a shop and it was a jeweller's and a pawn shop. I actually feel that this ring, you know, knows a lot of things that I don't know and that I would like to know. Yeah, you know, I wish I could ask it questions and I wish it could talk to me and, like, tell me, like, who engraved it, what the shop might have looked like, you know, was it a busy street, you know. I've never been to Guyana, so all of this is in my imagination. What was that wedding day like? And, you know, what was it like in 1943? And, like, this ring witnessed lots of things I've heard about in stories and was, like, on her hand the entire time, the things that it's seen and witnessed. I suppose it's that it represents all the things that I don't know, and there's a lot of stuff that I don't know that I just accept that I'm never going to know. Sometimes if you can feel a bit lost in your identity or where you're from, you can look at that thing and it's a solid piece of evidence of something from somewhere else, from the place that your parents are from that you haven't been to. And it's reassuring in that you can tell the story of that. Like, this is where this ring is from, and like, I am from here, but I'm also from there. You know, and to be proud of the fact that, oh, look at this gold, isn't it a gorgeous colour? And it's like, it's a bit different to the gold you find here, and why, and you can talk about it. And I think the engraving just really, it's like that physical manifestation of that. Like, you can know that what the ring is, but to have that engraving in there, it just sort of gives you that bit of, I don't know, security or reassurance that you're not imagining it all. You know, that is your history, or that is where you're from.
The fact that you're buying an antique wedding ring obviously has all sorts of implications. So if you are superstitious and you don't want to have a ring which may have been due to a divorce or whatever, then you probably don't want an antique ring, because who knows what's happened. It's probably gone through many, many owners.
My name's Freddie McConnell, and I'm a journalist and a writer. I am wearing a ring that... It's funny, actually. I've never asked my grandma. I know it's my grandma's ring, but I don't know whether when she had it made. It was definitely made for her. It's inscribed with her initials, RAH. And I would guess that it was probably made for her when she was quite young, I suppose, and given to her by her parents. And it came to me by way of my sister, who has always sort of inherited any family jewellery that there's been floating around, because she would wear it and I wouldn't. I was always like very masculine growing up, but I grew up as a girl and then transitioned in my early 20s. And I think it was sort of around that time or soon after that that I became aware that that my sister had this ring that she wasn't wearing, and it was a family ring, and it felt like something I would like to have and to wear as a sort of link to family. Like, I love tradition, despite being, you know, queer and having radical politics and all that sort of stuff. I also am like deeply in love with traditional things and objects and ritual and that sort of thing. So this ring just felt like something that I needed to have, I suppose, as a link to my roots and my family. And my sister wasn't wearing it, and she initially didn't want me to have it because I have a reputation for losing things. So it's quite a long negotiation process of me being like, well, you're not literally not wearing it, it's just sitting on a box, could I have it, and then we can like check in and you can see that I haven't lost it, and I promise not to lose it, and I won't even take it off ever. And that was it must have been a good like 7 years ago now, and I haven't lost it. So it's really special. I really care a lot about it. And my grandma is kind of a badass. She was like a champion skier and could have played at Wimbledon, I once remember her saying, but wasn't allowed to by her dad. So she's like of that generation where she just could have reached incredible heights but wasn't allowed to, for various reasons to do with society and women and limitations and all that sort of stuff. So she's just an amazing person. I come from a family of a lot of really strong women who have achieved amazing things, or perhaps could have achieved amazing things if they'd been born in a slightly different time. And that means a lot to me. And yeah, I see myself in that lineage, even though I'm trans and I'm a man. I sort of don't think that in any way needs to sort of separate me from those strong women in my past. And being able to wear this ring as a connection to that is just, is really important to me.
Hallmarks, for example, which is also an engraving, invariably those add value to the item.
Because that's telling you when it was made. And like the
exactly,
quality.
When it was made, who made it, the city it was made in. We've got an incredible hallmarking system in this country, which is second to none, which has been going since around the 12th century, which is still used today. And for the most part, you can trust it. It's very, very difficult to fake. That kind of thing adds value, it says. 18 carat, it's got the initials of the maker. It's got, for example, an anchor, which is very, very common in antique jewellery. So that represents Birmingham, which is traditionally our manufacturing hub. And then it might have a crown, which represents Great Britain. And a letter as well, which will denote the year. So you look up in the hallmark directory and match up all of those marks, and it will tell you exactly which year it was made in. That adds value, personality to the piece, gives you a bit of context. People tend to like those a lot.
can you just like see the marks and be like ding ding ding?
Then no, I can't.
You can't.
No, I'm not. I don't have a photographic memory enough.
What do we have here?
So we have a sterling silver Victorian Edwardian maid's badge with the name Eliza engraved on it. So this, we've got many of these, and they're relatively common in the antiques trade, but they're quite intriguing. They're essentially the same as the plastic name tags that employees are given in department stores, but they're made of sterling silver. And they are names like Eliza and Gertrude and Bertha and things like that, predominantly women. They were given to the maids and the help generally in well-to-do households in that period. So this one is dated 1876. And I mean, there are thousands and thousands of these on the market. Yeah, there's all this lovely detailed engraving around the name, which they all have generally, which is just very typical of the Victorians. And they would engrave everything, give everything a pattern border.
Is this kind of level of effort going into the name tag, is that a signal of expectation that that person would be working in that household for a long time?
Well, I mean, I think this is open to interpretation. I've heard various things over the years. One of them has been that if your name was Eliza and you went to work in a house and they didn't have an Eliza name badge, they only had a Bertha, that would be your name for the duration of your tenure. So who knows? I'm sure that they were made for people that were employed for a while. But at the same time, you know, imagine there was quite a turnaround. So
yeah.
You can see how you'd be given a different name. But yeah, the level of detail is the same on all of them, which is quite incredible. Because if you think about if somebody had to make that today, it would take a long time. If it was an expert, it would still take a couple of days, I would have thought. Think about how it's done today, you know. You punch it out of the machine and it's done in seconds.
It's not quite as cool as this one.
Not quite.
Yeah. Without the engraving, like obviously you would just think it's a Leatherman.
This engraved Leatherman multi-tool belongs to Ava Salin, who is originally from Finland but lived in London for several years. It was passed on to her by her father, who had received it as a gift for his work with the local scout organisation.
They engraved it with his name, and my dad already had like a few Swiss knives and a Leatherman, so he decided to give it to me. And this was like maybe 2011 or something. I was studying architecture at the time in London, and I just had the Leatherman around, and it was kind of handy at home. And then my boyfriend at the time, he was like, "Oh, can I borrow your Leatherman?" And he really wanted to carry it around all the time. So I gave it to him, and it came in like a leather pouch, and the pouch you can just put it around your belt, and so you can carry the Leatherman around all the time. So that's what he did, except my ex-boyfriend Dom. Dom decided to put the pouch the wrong way around, instead of having the opening and the snap facing upwards. So if the snap, like if he forgets to put the snap on, the Leatherman wouldn't fall out. But Dom being Dom, he was persistent, and he was like, "Oh, but like it's faster to take it out if it's like the other way around, so upside down."
So he did it on purpose.
Yes.
And I was like, so
"No, that's not a good idea." But anyway, he was carrying it. He always had it with him because it's kind of handy. He was also studying architecture, so it's like handy to have a multi-tool and a knife and stuff around. And then, of course, like maybe a few months after, he just lost the Leatherman. So he was cycling around somewhere in London, and then the Leatherman just fell off the pouch onto the streets of London. So obviously that was a lost cause. So this was around maybe 2013, like when it got lost.
When Dom originally lost the Leatherman, were you like angry or upset, or did you feel like that was like a loss of like a sentimental object? Or
yeah, I did, because it's just a handy thing to have, and I mean I was a student at the time, so I didn't really have money to replace it. So I was really angry, and it was like double frustrating because it was like kind of like, "I told you so," like, "Don't go carrying things upside down because it's gonna fall out." So it was, yeah, it was a bit, it was frustrating. And I never told my dad that it got lost.
Oh, you didn't? Okay, so he never knew.
You were just hoping he'd never ask about the Leatherman again.
For him, it wasn't really a sentimental item. It was just like something that the scouts felt like they had to give him something out of gratitude. And then he was like, I don't really need it.
Or did it feel at the time, like when your dad gave it to you, did you see it as more just like, oh, it's just like a practical, handy tool to have? Or did it feel sentimental to you because your dad gave it to you and it was engraved with his name?
Yeah, I think, so I've lived abroad since I was 19. So I don't really have much of my family around. So it was kind of like something, you know, if I have to like fix a screw or like do something around the house, use pliers or whatever, I would just use the Leatherman. And then obviously it had my dad's name on it. So it was a bit like having like a remote dad in the form of an object. You know, he's really like handy and he would do a lot of repairs around the house and stuff. So I was like, yeah, this is kind of like a bridge between, you know, him not being able to help me because I live abroad, but, you know, at least he gives me the tool.
Like a little mini stand-in robot dad. That's really lovely.
There's this side to the Leatherman that's not really sentimental. It's just like depressing. So once we were just cycling around in London and it was like a super quiet roundabout with no cars coming. So we decided to just go through the red lights because it's often safer to have a clear road without cars rather than like waiting for the green light and then all the cars trying to overtake you when you're trying to turn into the roundabout. So we did that. And then my ex-dom is black and we got stopped over by the police. It ended up with Dom being arrested and taken into custody for hours. And he was charged on, like, he had some homeopathic medicine with him and the Leatherman on his belt in the pouch. It hadn't fallen off by then, unfortunately. So for the Leatherman, he got charged with a deadly weapon. And then, of course, so like he was held in custody. Like, I'm white and he's black and he's got dreadlocks. So I don't know if they were just assuming that like he must have been working for a gang or whatever. And then, of course, because I'm white, like I didn't get anything. I didn't even get fined for cycling through the red lights, but he got fined for cycling through the red lights. Charged for the A-class drugs and the deadly weapon. And then he was like under review for 3 months. Like the Leatherman in that context, suddenly, you know, my ex was carrying it around because it was really handy for architecture school, for building things or whatever. But like in the context of pretty racist police officers, like suddenly the Leatherman just became something they could charge against him. If I'm carrying it as a white female, like, oh, I'm like into DIY and I'm crafty and I'm like independent woman, it's like positive. But if like a young black guy is carrying it, he's part of a gang and like gonna go and stab someone to death.
So the first time the Leatherman went missing was when the police confiscated it. Then a little later, as aforementioned, the Leatherman fell out of the pouch as Dom was cycling around London. And Ava assumed it was gone for good.
However, fast forward to this year, this spring, I got a really random text by a Finnish friend of mine. What's the name of your dad in Finnish? And I was like, oh, this is strange. And then I told her. And then she's like, oh, yeah, I think I found a Leatherman, like a multi-tool that belongs to your dad. And I just couldn't believe it because it was like 5 years ago that it got lost.
That friend's husband worked in a brewery in London. He had also lost his Leatherman, so his colleague suggested he replace it with another Leatherman sitting in the brewery's lost and found. He didn't really want that one because it was the cheapest model of Leatherman.
He was really confused why anyone would buy the cheapest model of the Leatherman and then engrave it with their name. But of course, that's what you would do if you were, you know, a scout. It was special for them to engrave it, but they didn't really have much money, apparently.
So he gave the Leatherman to his wife, Ava's friend.
And when she got it, she was like, this name rings a bell.
And after 5 years, the Leatherman and Ava were reunited.
I don't know how on earth, because like the crazy thing is that the Leatherman had been circulating. It had been probably used or carried around by the person who picked it up when Dom dropped it onto the ground. and it's just been like, you know, in use, and then randomly 5 years after being used, it's lost by its new owner and found again. And already, like, the odds of it being found from the street is pretty, you know, random. And then also the odds of being found by a Finn. And I don't really know any Finns in London either.
Do you feel like if you lost the Leatherman again now, would you just be like, oh, well, I'm sure it'll make its way back to me?
Yeah, I'm just going to, like, lose it in, like, Kyrgyzstan on a hike and then, like, assume it will come back to me when I'm, like, on holiday in Thailand or something.
Exactly, yeah. Just wait, I'm sure it'll show up somewhere.
No, I mean, I really don't think this is, like, something that's going to be replicated. I don't think I would trust losing something or leaving something lying around and then it finding its way back to me. I don't think that's going to happen again.
Yeah.
I don't intend to lose my Leatherman again.
You heard from Stephen Yardley, Max Ullman, Lisa Hack, Freddie McConnell, and Eva Salin. They were all talking to producer Arlie Adlington. And in today's Mini Illusionist, I ask Arlie why he's interested in words hammered into pieces of metal. Arlie, what has got you interested in bits of metal with writing on?
Well, I think one thing is that I just kind of love trinkets. I just love trinkets. So I feel like that's part of it, is that secretly I just want to talk about and think about shiny objects all the time.
Like an audio magpie.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I don't wear much in the way of jewellery and stuff, but I am always admiring other people's, even if it's not like a style or something that I would wear. I still appreciate what other people are getting up to in terms of their like trinket collections.
But you do have a trinket yourself.
I do have one, yes. I have one trinket, which is a ring. It's like a silver ring, which is engraved with some words that I got engraved on the ring.
Are they secret words?
Well, they won't be anymore. Let me just get it off so I can look at it.
Do you wear it all the time?
Yeah, I wear it every day. I usually wear it on my right hand, on my middle finger, or my swear finger, as I was about to call it, and then I remembered that's not actually what it's called.
Well,
but that one, yeah. And it says on it the words resist, defy, forge, and thrive. So those are words that I decided to get engraved on this ring because I felt like they were really strong words that were kind of aspirational in terms of different aspects of how I wanted to live my life, and kind of specifically as like a queer person and a trans person. Yeah, I guess it's like a kind of aspirational thing. It's like resist is about like, you know, resisting whatever kind of external pressures you feel to like, you know, not be the person that you are. Defy is like being a person that defies whatever expectations and just is true to yourself. Forge is like, to me, that means like, you know, like try to make things the way you want it, try to make your life the way you want it, try to make the world the way you want it. And then thrive is like the super aspirational, actually just like live an amazing life. And I had a time a few years ago where I was in Berlin just on a trip with some friends and my girlfriend at the time. I think it was one of the really early experiences I had after I'd kind of realized I was trans and I wasn't really having to interact with anybody who was going to misgender me, or everyone around me was just like affirming who I was. And it felt like a really just like lovely space to be in where I felt really affirmed. And I felt, I guess, like a little taste of that, like, oh, imagine if just the whole world was like this all the time, you know, how different my life would feel and be. And after that trip, I was trying to hold on to that kind of experience of the world that I had in that place, and that was when I like thought about these words and wanted to like have a way to try to, I guess, in a similar way that people get tattoos of words or whatever that they want to like try to remember, it was just like a way of trying to hold on to that feeling. I don't know why I was drawn to engrave the words on something rather than get them tattooed or whatever, because I do have tattoos. I could have done that, but it just wasn't the thing that I thought to do. No, I think another thing I like about it being like an actual physical object is that maybe one day I'll feel like I have drawn all the strength I need from this thing, and maybe I'll end up giving it to somebody else that needs it. This is the thing that reminds me what the real world is. If the world is making me feel, I don't know, like my understanding of who I am as a person is just like my imagination, or that's something, that's an illness that I have or something like that. You know, I want to always remember there might be people that like want me and people like me to feel like that's the truth, but that's not the truth. Like the real world, even if you don't get to feel it all the time, is the one where this thing that you know about yourself, that is just true. And so, yeah, I kind of like think of it that way a bit as well. It's like a physical object that can act as like a reminder of that reality, I suppose.
So it's like an anchor and a talisman.
Yeah, exactly. I had one experience fairly recently. It was when I was seeing a doctor who I was seeing about gender stuff and like getting hormones and things. And I had this appointment that I found like really upsetting. Like the doctor said loads of stuff to me that I was just really like not expecting in terms of, or stuff that was like not cool. I'm on testosterone now and going through that transition process. He had asked me about who I'm attracted to, like who I date, that kind of thing, which wasn't actually really relevant. I'm really not sure why he was asking me about that, but that's the kind of thing that happens in these appointments a lot. And he decided to just tell me, like he was just informing me. He said, yeah, so in the future, most of the women you date are going to identify as straight women. It was just like a thing that totally threw me, because, and which I kind of, after processing it afterwards, I realized it was upsetting because I felt like he was expressing this idea that like the ultimate goal of you going on testosterone is to basically, you know, stop being trans, like stop being queer. You can just become like a normal straight person. And, you know, he was talking about dating straight women as if that was some kind of upgrade, like you can graduate from having to be queer and just date straight women, you know? And it was just like, it was really upsetting because I was like, I love queer women. I don't want to stop dating queer women. I don't want to stop being queer. That's not my objective with any of this.
And also, how is any of this his business?
Exactly. Why are we even talking about it? It's like, your job is to, you're an endocrinologist. You measure hormone levels in people's bloodstreams. But okay, after that appointment, I had this actual, it was the most I've ever felt the kind of like power of having this ring, because I think I felt so destabilized by the things that were said in that appointment. I actually really did have an experience of kind of walking down the street in the middle of nowhere, trying to find a bus back to where I needed to go, and really feeling like the one thing that was grounding me and making me not feel like I'd just completely disappeared to a different planet was this ring. And so I have had at least one moment where it made a really big difference. It felt like the one thing in that moment that I had that was like reminding me that my understanding of who I am as a person and my reality was the actual truth, not what someone else was trying to tell me. It is kind of vulnerable in a way. Like, you, when I got this ring engraved, you have to go in and like tell a stranger what words you want engraved on a thing, which is kind of like you're telling them something personal and intimate. And they're obviously just like whatevs, and I'm sure they probably at this point don't even think much about it, but it's still for you, it's like you have to go and like you have to tell a person what you want. And
isn't that the same when you get a tattoo though?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, you're like, oh, hope they don't think I'm stupid.
Whereas they probably don't give a shit.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe they're secretly thinking, yeah, yes, that's a really good one. I don't want to say.
That's the dream. That is the dream.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is nacelle. Noun. 1. The outer casing on an aircraft engine. 2. Chiefly historical, the car on an airship. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by Arlie Adlington and me, Helen Zaltzman. The music is by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com. Check out his songs. Do you have an engraved thing that you love? Let me know over Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Illusionist Show is the handle. Pics, please.
You can hear or read every episode of The Allusionist, find out more about all of the people who appear on the show, view the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, pick up some merch at the show's forever home, theallusionist.org.